All right, hello. I heard Lynn was tired of talking, and I heard that she had some interesting situations arise. I don't know what they were, pal talk stuff, while she was on, so we'll see what happens while I'm on. I'm suffering from a horrible problem, which hopefully I can get out of my mind as we start teaching. It's not really that bad. It's just that my boyfriend wants very much to get me something for Christmas, and I honestly cannot think of anything I want. And I tried going on the internet and looking at stuff to see if I'd say, oh, I want one of those, and I can't think of anything. So if anybody knows what I want for Christmas, feel free to tell me, because I honestly cannot think of anything, and he wants to get me something. Danielle is a stuck record. She keeps saying puppy. And I said, I don't want a puppy. But, you know, lots of times when Christmas runs around, there's like a weakness in my wardrobe somewhere. Like I need some sweaters, or I need some jeans, or I need something. But this year there are no weaknesses in my wardrobe. Last year he bought me that lovely painting, the Diego Rivera painting, which I wanted. During the year, he got me a Keurig for coffee. He got me a crock pot. He got me one of those little stereos that you stick your iPhone in and you can hear. I mean, he just bought me everything. I cannot think of anything I want. I have everything. And I probably would want a really nice big warm sweater, but Teddy got me one of those. So... And Danielle got me a dream catcher. There's just nothing left. Danielle keeps saying puppy. So that's my problem. That's what I'm struggling with, trying to come up with something I want. And I can't. So we'll put that aside for now. Maybe something will pop into my awareness later. So we're here for... Seven Steps to Awakening. See, I can't even think of spiritual books I want because I'm only reading a couple, and they're, you know, I'm reading the Seven Steps to Awakening and the Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss, and I'm not feeling at all to read anything else. There's no spiritual books I want. Interesting, isn't it? Is Ron still here? No, he. Get a massage. I did think about something like that, maybe, Dove. Some kind of spoiling myself kind of thing, a gift certificate. I did think about maybe if I can't come up with something else doing that. But no, Ron went home Friday, so he's not physically here. He's back in Massachusetts right now. All right, so we're here now for the Seven Steps to Awakening. And tonight we're going to begin with quote number 410. So what I'm going to do is give you a link to quote number 410 in the room so that if you want to read along with me when we go to my journal, you can. Lynn says she has an idea. We'll talk. Maybe she knows something I want. I do need ideas. Isn't that funny? Because I want to give him the gift of something that I want so that he can buy it for me because he wants to. So here's the link to number 410. For those of you who are listening on the radio, if you want to join us, you can just go to RDA7. That is the digit 7. It is not spelled out. RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. And when you get to that blog up on the menu bar, you'll click on step 2. That's the step that we're on. And then click on the numbering sequence that will allow you to find your way to number 410, because that's where we are, number 410. And what I would like to do is just take a few moments of silence before we get started. So why don't we do that now? Amen. All right. So I'm going to begin by reading quote number 410 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. This is originally from the Supreme Yoga, and this is the quote. Nothing has really become physical or material. So that's the extent of the quote right there. Nothing has really become physical or material. So why don't we go to the Seven Steps journal and see what I wrote after contemplating that. The body and its five senses verify the physical world. And yet, the body is part of the changing, observable world. When I is separated from object, body is seen as object. All objects are part of the mind's perceivable world. Mind's perceivable world is a world of cause and effect, yet both cause and effect are separate from I, and neither affect it. If I is not affected, cause and effect do not exist. This means mind's perceivable world does not exist, and this is observable by observing non-effect. If mind's perceivable world does not exist, body, which is a part of that world, does not exist. That which has no existence cannot verify reality. So there's a lot said here, but what's really happening is a lot of these thoughts that are shared in the journal at number 410 are kind of summaries of what's been seen through inquiry in this journal prior to number 410. So it's kind of pulling everything together. Last week, we were looking at cause and effect, the appearance of cause and effect, where, you know, we're originally taught, or at least I was originally taught when I started the spiritual path, that my thoughts were the cause of my experience. So, for example, I saw a thought today. It's kind of funny. It popped up. It's a thought I literally haven't seen in years. But when it popped up, I recognized it as a thought I used to believe a lot. And I just assumed when it popped up today, I just said to it, well, I guess you've come to be healed then. You know, you were buried down there somewhere and you came up to be healed. But the thought was, I don't want to be happy. That was the thought. And I know that I used to have that thought in my mind, you know, like when there would be a time when I would be, grumpy for whatever reason, and, you know, somebody's trying to cheer me up, and there would just be this knowing that I don't want to be happy. You know, I want to hold on to this grumpiness today. And I saw that thought today, but I haven't seen it in a long time. But anyway, what I was getting to was that on my spiritual path, one of the first things I learned is that it's believing thoughts that causes my experience. So as an example, this thought that I saw today is a thought I used to sometimes believe. I don't want to be happy, right? I just don't want to be. And when I was believing that thought, then my experience would be a grumpy experience. At best, or it could even go to an angry or hateful experience if I let it go that far. And before I was on the spiritual path, I didn't really even see the thought, I don't want to be happy. These thoughts are kind of hidden from view, or, you know, as the Course says, they're unconscious. So a part of the spiritual path appears to be, in the beginning, learning what is actually causing the experience. I went through a lot of practice of being willing to see the thoughts in my mind, being willing to see thoughts like, I don't want to be happy, so that I could find the cause of my grumpy to hateful experience, right? The culprit, you could say, the cause thought. But last week, what we looked at was really beyond even that understanding of cause and effect. Last week, what we started to look at is what is being called here in this particular journal entry, I. I is the core self, capital S self. It is not, the personality. I is absolutely changeless, always constant. You could say eternally at peace. And as I've been looking at I through this journal, what I notice is that both cause and effect are actually at the level of mind, or we could say the level of ego. The thought, I don't want to be happy, certainly is at the level of mind. But then that experience of grumpiness to hatefulness is also at that level of mind. Because I, the true self, is completely unaffected. And so really what's happening, it seems, when we're on this spiritual path, the first step where we seem to be learning that our thoughts are the cause of our experience, that first step is really pointing towards, in the direction of truth, is pointing towards truth, but it's not ultimately a truth. Because the true self is never affected by any thought. The true self is not affected by, I don't want to be happy. The true self is not affected by, this is the greatest day ever. The true self is not affected by, oh shit, I blew it again. The true self is not affected by, look what a great job I did. The self that goes up and down as we are believing these thoughts is the false self or the ego. So both the cause and the effect are at the level of false self. So it seems like somehow when we first start this spiritual path, we are actually changing the false self from a false self that fully believes in the world and fully believes our thoughts to a false self that is more at peace because it's no longer believing the thoughts, no longer believing the world. And then somehow from this happier false self point of view, we start to become aware of the self that never changed. The self that didn't fall asleep, therefore is not awakening. Without actually coming into view, somehow it comes into view from a more peaceful false self. And then we start to realize that cause and effect is completely illusory. Because cause and effect only affects the false self. It never touches the true self. This is when we begin to get an understanding that's beyond intellectual understanding about what it means that the world is not real. It's not real because it has no effect. The true self is never, ever affected in any way. It's absolutely changeless. And again, this is what the opening to A Course in Miracles talks about. Let's see if I have a course nearby. I do. I have lots of courses laying around, but they're not always right here at my computer. Right? A Course in Miracles says in the introduction, this course can therefore be summed up very simply in this way. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Right? So, and herein lies the peace of God. So when it says nothing real can be threatened, it is talking about that changeless self that is not affected. There is no cause and effect. If there was a cause and effect that could affect the changeless self, well then that would mean that the changeless self could be threatened, right? But there is no cause and effect that can affect the changeless self. There is no thought that creates an experience for the true self that is any different from reality. That doesn't happen. The true self never changes. So anything that appears to change, any cause, any effect, anything that appears to be affected, all falls into the category of unreal. And therefore it does not exist. If you look at the introduction to A Course in Miracles right before the part that I read you, it says, the Course does not aim at teaching the meaning of love, for that is beyond what can be taught. It does aim, however, at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence, which is your natural inheritance. The opposite of love is fear. But what is all-encompassing can have no opposite. And then it goes on to say, this course can therefore be summed up very simply in this way. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Herein lies the peace of God. So when the course says it does not aim at teaching the meaning of love, what the course means is it cannot teach us what our true self is. That is beyond what can be taught. That is something that needs to be directly experienced or realized directly. It does, however, aim at removing the blocks to the awareness of love's presence. And this is why the Course teaches us about the cause and effect. Because that belief in our thoughts and that belief in the experience and the belief that I am affected, that I have good days and that I have bad days, all of that illusory belief is the block to the awareness of love's presence. So when we're learning about cause and effect and we're learning to let go of thoughts that cause certain reactions like the belief in guilt, the belief in unworthiness, the belief in fear, etc., etc., what we're really doing is removing these blocks to the awareness of love's presence. But love itself is never affected. So you could say that all healing occurs at the illusory level because there isn't any healing needed at the level of truth. So let's look back at 4:10. If we look at the original quote that came from the Supreme Yoga, it says, nothing has really become physical or material. Nothing has really become physical or material. So if we look at what I wrote as I was contemplating that line, the body and its five senses verify the physical world. So, for example, right now I am drinking a cup of warm tea with, it's black tea with cream and sugar in it. And I can reach out with my hand and I can feel the warmth of the cup. This tells me that the cup is real. It's here. I can sip the tea. I can hear the noise of me sipping. I can hear the noise of me swallowing. I can taste the tea. This really tells me that both the tea and me, a body, is real because of this sensory experience of feeling the tea, hearing the sipping, feeling the swallow, tasting the tea. But if we look directly at what is verifying all of this reality, it is the senses, it is the body. Notice what I used as evidence that the tea existed and that, quote, I existed, were this sense of sight. I see the cup. Touch, I feel the warmth. Sound, I hear the sip. Taste, I taste the tea. Right? And what has these senses? Well, the body has these senses. So through the body's five senses, we say, unless we have learned not to, but the average person says, the world is real. I remember when I used to listen to some old David Hoffmeister recordings that he used to have from an earlier period, I think from sometime in the 90s. And he used to have those up on his website. I don't know if he still does, but I used to go and listen to them. And I was sitting in this one room in my house where I would sit on a beanbag chair next to my computer while I was listening. And there was this bookshelf that was just right across the room. So my eyes were always just kind of looking at the bookshelf. It was what was naturally in front of me. And I would listen to David Hoffmeister teaching that the world is not real. And I would look at that bookshelf and I would say, but that looks real, right? It looks real. You see, I was defining real as that which can be perceived or verified. Oops, they're saying no sound. Okay, 1 second. I guess we're having the same kind of problems that Lynn said she had. Hi, can you hear me this time? Yes, okay, good. Well, then I'll try and continue. I'm not sure where you lost me, but the point that I was making is that, you know, when we feel that I left off with David Hoffmeister. Yes, I was listening to David Hoffmeister, listening to his tapes, and you know, looking at a bookshelf that just was naturally in front of my eyes as I sat in that beanbag chair listening. And, you know, David would say, the world is not real. You know, this is what he was teaching on his tapes. And I would look at that bookshelf. I distinctly remember looking at that bookshelf and saying, but that looks so real. You know, it looks so real. And that's how we tend to define real. We tend to define real as that which is verified by our five senses. If I can hear it, see it, taste it, touch it, smell it, it's real. This is the way that, unless we come to see otherwise, this is the way that most of us are in the world. We call it real because of our direct experience through the body's five senses. So, with that said, if we go back and look at number 410, the body and its five senses verify the physical world. And yet, the body is part of the changing, observable world. So what we talked about a moment ago when I was reading from A Course in Miracles is that the self is absolutely changeless. The self, there is no cause, there is no effect that touches the self. Therefore, all cause and all effect is illusory because it has no actual effect. It doesn't do anything, right, to the self. It doesn't do anything. Anything that appears to change because of cause and effect is illusory. It's not real. And if we look at the body obviously appears to change. One of the primary things that seems to affect the body, one of the primary causes, is time. You know, a one-day-old body is a lot different from a five-year-old body, and which is a lot different from a 21-year-old body, which is a lot different from a 60-year-old body, which is still a lot different from a 99-year-old body, if the body's still hanging around, right? So, bodies are a part of the illusion. So if we use the example, I've used this example before, if we use the example, if we think of an illusion for a moment, just temporarily, as a cartoon. So this cup of tea is actually a cartoon cup of tea. And a cartoon body reaches out and touches the cartoon cup of tea. The cartoon body may perceive the cartoon cup of tea as real because they are the same. But they're both just cartoons. They're both illusory. So what this is saying is we may think that we can verify reality through the senses, but if the body itself is illusory, you're asking an illusory component to verify reality. How could an illusory mechanism do that? An illusory mechanism is not going to know the difference between reality and illusion. So when it encounters another illusory object, it's going to say, yes, that's real. But that doesn't mean it's real. You can't ask something illusory to verify reality. So the body and its five senses appear to verify the physical world, but since the body is a part of the changing, observable, illusory world, it can't really do that. It can't verify what reality is. When I, meaning the core self, the changeless self, is separated from the body, if you really, really look, you will realize there's something about you that was present at your earliest memory, whether that was age 3, 4, 5, has been present in every moment of your life since then, whether it was a happy moment, an unhappy moment, a sick moment, a healthy moment, a proud moment, a moment of unworthiness, a moment when you were in love, a moment when you were angry and breaking up. There's this presence, or the word often used is awareness, or the word I like is isness, but it's you. It's always been there, and it's always been exactly the same. Even while you seem to be shifting and changing between anger and happiness, pride and unworthiness, this awareness always stayed the same. That is what is being called I here. And when there is enough clearing away of the obstacles to love's presence so that you can become aware of I, then you begin to notice how I is indeed changeless. And you also begin to notice how everything that changes is temporary and therefore unreal. And the body falls into that category. The journal says, all objects are part of mind's perceivable world. Objects are those things that change, not necessarily just physical things like my cup of tea, but even thoughts are objects. Anything that changes is called an object. All objects are a part of mind's perceivable world, which means they're a part of illusion. Mind's perceivable world is a world of cause and effect. Time causes the body to change. A thought, I don't want to be happy, causes an emotional change, right? Mind's perceivable world is a world of cause and effect, yet both cause and effect are separate from I and neither affect it. As the body ages, awareness stays the same. As emotions change, awareness stays the same. If I is not affected, then cause and effect do not exist. Nothing real can be threatened. Nothing unreal exists. Only that which is changeless is true. So I is true. Cause and effect, thoughts that seem to come and go, moods which seem to change, bodies which appear to change, they're unreal. They do not exist. And this means, if none of these things exist, then mind's perceivable world also does not exist. And this is observable by observing non-effect. What that means is if you really pay attention to I, really pay attention to awareness, really pay attention to that core of what you are, you'll notice that it never, ever changes. It never wavers even one little bit. And the more you notice this, the more you learn the difference between what is real and what is not real. If mind's perceivable world does not exist, body, which is a part of that world, also does not exist. That which has no existence cannot verify reality. So really what this is saying is you can't take the five senses as proof of reality. In fact, the interesting thing is the five senses can't sense reality. They aren't aware. They can't verify awareness. That's prior to the senses. So this is a pretty big unlearning, since it seems to be natural for us to verify what things are and verify reality through our senses. And now what this is saying is that our senses are not credible evidence of reality, because they themselves are part of a body which changes, which means it is not real. So you have an unreal body. Therefore, the senses are not valid evidence regarding what is or is not true. That changes the way we've always verified reality. That changes everything. It doesn't matter if I can see the bookshelf across the room. That doesn't mean that it's real. If I can't use the senses to verify reality, that changes everything. All right, let's scroll down and click on number 411 underneath the comment and reply area. I'll also post a link to number 411 in the room. All right. This is 411 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. Again, this is originally coming from the Supreme Yoga. That which has a beginning has an end. When all things that have a beginning are ruled out, what remains is the truth, which is the cessation of ignorance. Okay, so we just talked about how the five senses cannot verify reality because they themselves are a part of an illusory body. You can't have something illusory tell you what reality is. So that raises the question, well, how can I verify reality then? If the senses aren't to be trusted, what is there that can be trusted? And this provides one answer to that question. That which has a beginning has an end. When all things that have a beginning are ruled out, what remains is the truth, which is the cessation of ignorance. This is similar to the neti, which some of you may have heard about. This is really saying the best way to verify what is real is by ruling out everything that is not real. When you rule out everything that is not real, what's left, when all the not real has been taken away, what's left, that's reality. And this is saying one symptom, I guess, one way to tell that something is not real is that it has a beginning. Anything at all that has a beginning is not real. And again, if we're looking at the body, we know that that means that the body is not real, because we know that the body had a beginning. The earth. You know, the earth, at least we're taught that it had a beginning. The universe as a whole, we're taught, has a beginning. Yeah, Deva's quoting workbook lesson 133 from A Course in Miracles. What begins in time and ends in time has no value. That is the same as this quote from the Supreme Yoga. That which has a beginning has an end. When all things that have a beginning are ruled out, what remains is the truth, which is the cessation of ignorance. All right, let's look at the journal entry for number 411. When all things that are observable are ruled out, that which remains is true. Likewise, when all things that have a beginning are ruled out, that which remains is true. This can be investigated, and yet there is doubt. Now, when I say yet there is doubt, this is me showing self-honesty in my own personal journal. What if the investigator has a beginning? Would it know this? Can it discern? Or is the investigator like the body, part of the illusion and therefore unable to verify reality? This is a valid question and belongs in an honest inquiry. So when I'm talking about the investigator, what I'm talking about is the mind. The mind, from what I understand through my metaphysical learning, oh, we've lost sound again. Okay, let me try. As I was mentioning, what we saw in the previous journal entry, number 410, is that we could not use the body to verify what is real because the body itself is illusory. And now I'm being asked to use inquiry or investigation to rule out what is not real, to rule out things that are observable, things that have a beginning and an end, because they're not real. Sorry, to rule them out, and then what's left is real. But the question or the doubt that came up in my mind as I was contemplating this was, but what is it that investigates, or what is it that follows an inquiry process? Isn't that the mind? And doesn't the mind itself have a beginning? If the mind itself has a beginning, doesn't that mean it's illusory? And if the mind is illusory, can it be trusted in an inquiry process to know the difference between what is true and what is not true? In other words, isn't the mind as poor a judge of reality as the body? And this question has to be answered, because until this question is answered, I am not going to trust even my mind's clarity that comes during investigation. I have to find out if I can trust the clarity that comes during investigation, or is that evidence as muddled as the body's five senses? So again, that's what number 411 really brings up. Would the mind know what reality is and what is illusion? Can the mind discern? And I said this is a valid question and belongs in an inquiry. So I've placed this question in my journal, and then I'm going to move forward. I'm not going to worry about the answer or think about the answer, because that would be mind attempting to answer. I simply put the question out there, and then I go on. So let's go on to number 412. You can scroll below the comment and reply area and click on number 412. I will also put a link to 412 in the room. I think I will. I may be locked up. Yeah, maybe I won't put a link in the room. Maybe I won't do that. Oh, wait. Nah. That's just too much of a struggle. So no link in the room. Sorry about that. Oh, wait. Here it comes. It magically showed up. We'll see if it magically shows up for you. I clicked on send, but I don't think it's gone yet. First, I'm going to read number 412 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. This again is quoting the Supreme Yoga. This house, known as the body, has not been made by anyone, in fact. It is only an appearance, like the two moons seen by one suffering from diplopia, which I don't know what diplopia is, but apparently they see double. The moon is really only one. The duality is an optical illusion. The body is experienced to exist only when the notion of a physical body prevails in the mind. It is unreal. Did you need something, my love?
Yeah.
What?
I need to ask you, could you not turn off your computer after, because I have to print stuff, and I'll turn it off when I done print.
Okay, that sounds good. Okay, I'll read number 412 again. This house, known as the body, has not been made by anyone, in fact. It is only an appearance, like the two moons seen by one suffering from diplopia. The moon is really only one. The duality is an optical illusion. The body is experienced to exist only when the notion of a physical body prevails in the mind. It is unreal. So I'm going to go to number 412 now. I don't think the link ever showed up in the room, so I apologize for that. But here's what number 412 says. It has been seen that the body is experienced through the thought of body. And when this says it has been seen, that means that earlier in this journal, through the process of investigation and inner looking, I came to see that the reason the body is experienced is because of the thought of body. That if I did not have a belief in body, then there would be no experience of a body. So it has been seen that the body is experienced through the thought of body. The body is not directly experienced. When there is no thought, there is no experience. So the most common example of this is at night, when you are in a deep, deep sleep, you have no awareness of the body. If you're injured, you know, in a car accident or something, and you become unconscious, there is no awareness of the pain, right? Many people in deep meditation will tell you they have no awareness of the body. So only when the thought of body is present, when the consciousness that has the belief in body is present, is there an experience of body. When the consciousness that has a belief in body is not present, such as during deep sleep or unconsciousness, then there is no experience of a body at all. So again, starting with number 412, it has been seen that the body is experienced through the thought of body. The body is not directly experienced. When there is no thought, there is no experience. So a thought is necessary for the body to be experienced. It has also been acknowledged that a background belief in body leads to an assumption that body is always present. This assumption is like an always present thought, which leads to some degree of consistent experience. So this is why we wake up every day to the experience of a body after sleeping. The thought of body, the thought that body exists, is a very firm thought, a very core thought in the ego consciousness. And so we can't just say, for example, okay, I'm going to quit believing in the body. and then, because we said that, stop experiencing the body. The thought is too buried, too core, too much a part of the ego consciousness. And that's really all this says. This says that the experience of body exists because of a core belief in body. All right, so what we're going to do now is move on to 413. I'm going to scroll down and click on number 413. If you guys were in 412, you can scroll down and click in number 413. I don't think I can share the links in the room anymore. That appears not to be working for me. I will read number 413 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening. Remember, we do have a question on the table that has not been answered, and the question is, can the mind, which has a beginning, therefore it's illusory, be trusted during an investigation process when we're trying to determine the difference between what's real and what's not real? That's a question that's on the table that has not been answered. Moving on to number 413 from the book The Seven Steps to Awakening. There are thousands of such bodies, which have been brought into being by your thought force. Okay, so we just saw that the belief in body is what creates the experience of a body. And now the Supreme Yoga is adding to that, saying all of the bodies that you appear to see are because of your belief in body. There are thousands of such bodies which have been brought into being by your thought force. All right, so number 413 in the journal says, oh wait, is Dove posting for me? Way to go, Dove. I can't see what you're posting, but it looks like that's what you're doing. Number 413 says, each body seen represents the background belief assumption that the body is real and exists as reality. Each body seen is a call to awaken, to see the background belief assumption and question it presently, now. So what this means is, as I turn my chair and I look at Danielle, and I see Danielle over there working on dream catchers. She's finished mine and now she's making some more. The fact that I see Danielle sitting over there working on dream catchers means my ego is still intact. That's what this is saying. That consciousness, which is the ego, that has that core belief, I am a body, is what causes me to see a body over there that's called Danielle working on a dream catcher. Earlier in the Seven Steps to Awakening, we saw an exchange between Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj and a questioner. And Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj was teaching the same thing, that the world is not real, that the body is not real. And the questioner says to him, but I see you sitting there smoking a cigarette. And in fact, we also know that Nisargadatta ate meat, which was a little bit unusual for an Indian guru. I read recently he loved sex. That was new for me, but that's also a body function. So he smokes, he eats meat, he has sex, he loves sex, we're told. But when Nisargadatta said to this questioner, when the questioner said, I see you sitting there smoking a cigarette, Nisargadatta said to the questioner, that is your I am the body belief. You know, I've heard many times people say things like, you know, so-and-so couldn't have been awake. Maybe we'll even just say Sri Ramana Maharshi could not have been awake because he was still in a body. But the assumption that's being made there is that our seeing is the same as the sages seeing. But what seems to be coming up over and over and over again through the Seven Steps to Awakening is that's not true. If I see a sage in a body, that's because my ego is intact. It doesn't mean a thing about his ego. If I see Danielle sitting here making dream catchers, that means my ego is intact. It doesn't say a thing about Danielle. So to judge others based on our perception is an error. But one thing our perception does do, our perception is a wonderful report card for us because it tells me that I still need that healing or that awakening or that realization. So if I want to be completely vigilant, every time I see a body, I could ask the question, who am I? My eyes may appear to be looking at a body called Danielle, but the reason I see a body called Danielle is because I still believe I'm a body. So when my eyes land on Danielle, that can be a prompt for me to say, who am I? Or what am I? And to continually separate within my own awareness the difference between the core I, which never changes, and the body, and the senses, and the mind, which are all illusory. And the more I allow this separation to occur, the stronger my realization that I am the changeless core becomes, and the weaker my association with the false mind, thoughts, body, the weaker that association becomes. This is the advantage of being completely vigilant with self-inquiry. But most of us never think, when we look over there and we see Danielle working on a dream catcher, we never think to ask, who am I? We want to say, oh, Danielle, what are you doing? You know, we immediately go into the world. This is what we do. Immediately fall right into that belief. I'm a body, she's a body, and our interest is, what are you doing? We all do it. But the recommendation that's being made here in 4.13 is that we remember that every moment is a practice opportunity, a spiritual practice opportunity. Every time our eyes land on another, quote, body, that's an opportunity for us to practice self-inquiry, to ask, who am I? Because I couldn't see a body if I didn't believe I was a body. So each body seen represents the background belief assumption that the body is real and exists as reality. Each body seen is a call to awaken, to see the background belief assumption and to question it presently, now. So, you know, one of the things that some of us talk about a little bit is the awareness, watching awareness practice that is recommended by Michael Langford in his book, The Most Direct Means to Eternal Bliss. But many of us don't have the ability to sit as Michael did in awareness, watching awareness 12 hours a day. It doesn't seem that our life right now would allow that. So if I'm able to sit in awareness, watching awareness for, let's say, 40 minutes, does that mean that my practice is limited to 40 minutes? And the answer is no. Because there are so many practices that if I want to be completely vigilant, I can be practicing constantly even as I'm up and moving around in the world. This is giving one example of a practice that I don't think I've ever done, to be honest. I'm so glad I'm reviewing it again. I don't look at Danielle and think, who am I? I look at Danielle and say, Danielle, that's such a nice dream catcher. But every body seen can be an opportunity to practice self-inquiry. We have so many opportunities if our willingness is strong enough. We have so many opportunities for the spiritual practice that awakens. I think that if most of us are completely self-honest, we have to just admit that the truth is our willingness is not yet strong enough. It may be strong enough to practice for an hour a day, or 2 hours a day, or 3 hours a day, or 4 hours a day, but at some point there's also this time when we're getting up and we're moving around and our attention is back fully into the world, fully into what the five senses are experiencing, as if it's completely real and meaningful. And we're not guilty for that. I don't point that out in order to increase anybody's ideas of guilt. But I point that out just so we can say, I do need to increase my desire to awaken. I do get pulled back into the world. If I was to, you know, put it on a chart, more hours of my day are spent believing the world than there are hours when that belief is held back. And a mathematical shift here would be helpful. It would be helpful if I was spending more of my waking hours in inquiry, in mantra, in the remembrance of purpose, in holding back and not being fully involved in the world, and instead recognizing the difference between what's false and what's true. And it's true, I can do that. I can do that even while I appear to be involved in other activities. This is something that can happen, and the only reason it's not happening is because I don't want it bad enough. Again, no guilt in that, but you know, before any, quote, problem can be resolved, I use the word problem here lightly. I really use it very lightly. before any problem can be solved, the problem has to be recognized. And if the problem is I'm just not interested enough yet, and I can admit that to myself, then what I can start doing is working on increasing my interest in awakening, increasing my interest in keeping that on my mind always. And maybe at some point, if I increase that interest enough, it's going to start happening to when my eyes land on a body, before I say, "Danielle, what are you doing?" I'm actually silently within myself saying, "Who am I? What am I?" I'm taking time to separate the false from the true first. And I guess that's all the time that I really have today. So tomorrow, we'll see. Maybe Pal Talk will be working tomorrow. Tomorrow I will come back and begin with number 414. And Dove, I guess I'm just going to hang up. But I love you, Dove, and thanks for letting me use your phone. And I'll see you tomorrow. Bye. Oops, I hung up on him. Okay, let me...
I'm making a dream catcher.